This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 12th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 417 and happy Thanksgiving. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, New Beginnings, the theme of the Thanksgiving weekend edition of the podcast. First, Michael Sachs explains why he left Vancouver to become the senior director of the Jewish Federation of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he reacts to the ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. And the BC legislature is back in session. What does the future hold for NDP Premier David Eby and Conservative Opposition Leader John Rostad? And what about new Green leader Emily Lowen, who does not have a seat in the legislature? Guests Alan Mullen, former Chief of Staff for Speaker Darrell Plekis, and Paul Stanley, the BC government's former Chief Security Officer. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. They say it is darkest before dawn. October 7th passed, the second anniversary of the worst day for Jews since the Holocaust, but it was marked by pro-Hamas protests in streets and on campuses throughout North America, all the way here in Vancouver, where people gathered on October 4th, ahead of October 7th, but we saw images come out of Montreal and Toronto on October 7th. October 8th, news that Israel and Hamas agreed to the first steps towards peace in Gaza, that we might have peace in the Middle East. The devil is in the details, as they say, but first steps forward, and the Israelis who were taken hostage October 7th will finally be freed to come back to their families and friends who've missed them so much. There will be more food and medical supplies sent into Gaza, a relief for those who were caught in the middle of a horrible war that Hamas asked for on October 7th. In July, Michael Sachs from Vancouver wrote in the National Post that he made the decision to leave Canada, to move his family from Canada to the United States. The column went viral. Michael Sachs wrote about the high cost of living in Canada, the decline of healthcare in Canada, the decline of public safety in Canada. After October 7th, 2023, it became dangerous to be Jewish in Canada, a country that once was a shining example to the rest of the world of peace, tolerance, order, and multiculturalism. Michael Sachs joins me from Tulsa. He's originally from Connecticut, but came to Vancouver in 1993. And before he left Vancouver, he was the first Western Canada director for the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal was the famous Holocaust survivor and Nazi hunter. Now, Michael, you are the senior director for the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. Before we get on to everything else, just describe what your job is and who the Federation is there in Tulsa.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. This is a topic that's really dear to my heart. Actually, pretty much everything in your opening is important to me. I'm the senior director at the Jewish Federation in Tulsa. We're a Jewish community here, similar to federations across North America, pretty much the umbrella organization for the community. And as senior director, I'm kind of the Swiss Army knife, I like to say. I pretty much can be put and plugged into wherever is needed. But I'm focusing heavily on advocacy, community relations, and outward-facing relationships with the Federation.
We're doing this interview. It's the morning of October 9th here in Vancouver. It's the afternoon of October 9th in Tulsa. Yeah. The ceasefire really is hours old, and people on both sides are hoping it'll last days, weeks, months, years into a lasting peace. There's people that still dream of a two-state solution, that the two can live side by side together. What is your first reaction of this the ceasefire deal that was brokered by the Americans, the Qataris, the Egyptians were involved?
I'll tell you, it's a big breath of relief from many, many, many people in the Jewish community across North America and obviously in Israel. This came about a lot faster than anyone thought it was going to come about. And the fact is that, yes, it's multi-phased. Phase one is, for majority of the people, the most important, which is the release of all the hostages, both living and deceased. I think that that has been a point of contention and a point of pain and suffering for the last 2 years for Jewish community across the world. And now we have a light at the end of the tunnel. We have a date. We have a hope. And I think that that is something that is, I'm a big Yankees fan. That's another reason, another thing for Canadians to not like about me. But I'm a big Yankees fan. And last night we lost to the Blue Jays, which is a great, they're looking great this year. And, you know, normally when that would happen, I'd be really down. But you know what? I was on a high yesterday with this news. My wife as well, our kids, everyone is just, we're hopeful. I mean, we're cautious because Hamas still, it's a terrorist organization. The ceasefires and stuff like that have not always been fully adhered to. But the belief is that there is really a strong foundation for this phase one to get completed. And, you know, at that time, they're going to start negotiating phase two. But phase one, hostages home. And I think that that is around the world right now, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish, that should be something to be celebrated, not something to be, picked and critiqued the way it might, that some people might do it. The real concern, I guess, I have as a Jewish community professional is, okay, well, how does this peace deal translate into what has been witnessed by Jewish community in North America, on the streets, at our doorstep, at our community centers, in our neighborhoods, and how will that manifest? And is it going to go down? Are they going to move on to the next hot button topic, or is there going to be a continuation of this anti-Semitism? The hardest part, I think, for people to realize and understand is that we can't, like, the last 2 years, many people turned their backs on the Jewish community. Many people started attacking their friends who are Jewish. Their Jewish friends' social circles collapsed. Their support circles collapsed. If they were from marginalized groups, those groups turned, in a lot of cases, turned on the Jewish community. And this is where we're really going to see where the rubber meets the pavement in North America, in Canada, and the U.S.
The Jewish people around the world are not the same as the Israeli lawmakers, the government. There's a lot of opinions on all sides of various Jewish communities. The prevailing opinion, of course, is for the endurance of Israel.
You know, you never thought you would see in Canada lists of Canadian citizens who served in the IDF. Not served in Gaza during this war, but served in the IDF 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. This was a witch hunt and something that is completely un-Canadian. I lived in Canada for 30 years. I love Canada. Canada is a phenomenal country. Just because I chose to leave with my family does not mean that I don't love Canada and the country it was and still could be. But it doesn't, you know, when we look at the stuff that we were seeing, I mean, Canadians deep down, they have a problem with what they were seeing. A study came out yesterday from ResearchGo that Sija quoted that 79% of British Columbians are concerned about anti-Semitism, right? 79% are concerned about anti-Semitism. 86% are concerned about attacks on Jewish spaces, synagogues, schools, and businesses, right? So these numbers aren't lying. Canadians do not like anti-Semitism, just like they do not like any other forms of hatred. The problem is there's been a really loud group, a really loud minority group that has a few, works with an organization or two that are Jewish in name and turn around and are controlling the narrative with aggressive style protests and targeting. And this is very un-Canadian. So how do we come back from that, right? How do the fellow Canadians expect the Jewish community to all of a sudden, like, we, you know, it's been 2 years of this, right? I personally had death threats. We have a community, our community had paid tons more money in security the policing of the city of Vancouver, the amount of money that they had to add to their budget just for because of the protests. I mean, this is not something that's easily forgotten.
Now, you wrote in the column about more than 100,000 Canadians leaving Canada in 2024, the highest number since 1967, the centennial year, and more than 27,000 in the first quarter of 2025. You're one of those that left, I guess, in the second or third, no, it'll be the third quarter. And here we are now in the fourth quarter. Now, you wrote about Canada becoming unrecognizable, but you're now in the United States. People who are watching this would ask, well, what about the United States? You know, the United States is going through a lot of turmoil under Donald Trump's second presidency. There's parts of the United States that have also been dangerous for Jews. Think of the murder of two Israeli embassy workers in Washington, D.C., outside the Capitol Jewish Museum. That was back in May. And then the next month in June, there was the attack on seniors in Boulder, Colorado, who were in a square just exercising their freedom of speech and their concern for the hostages as well. Those two incidents got a lot of attention as well, that things are not all right for Jews in the United States as well.
As Canadians and British Columbians, my family lost trust in the leadership to actually take the appropriate steps to combat anti-Semitism. And this is, you know, that's just one of, you know, a multitude of different factors that we took into consideration. Another one was the declining healthcare system in Canada. Now, mind you, I'm a big fan of Bob, of your, you know, your regular monitoring of ER wait times. Before we got on this call, I checked the wait times and they're 2-3 hours. In Vancouver. That's great. I'm so happy to see it moving to that direction, right? That's not, but when it came to the decision for us as a family at that time, we made the decision. 1 in 5 British Columbians still can't get a family doctor. I got a family doctor within 3 days of being here without using any connections or someone I know. I just picked up the phone and called and, you know, went and I was, the single doctor appointment I went, when I went to introduce myself, it was a 45-minute appointment. Now, do you have to pay for healthcare here? Yes. So the grass is never, it's not greener. And we just feel that we were at this stage where all these categories, we kind of gauged them out to see what was worth it for us. And I think that it'll all kind of come down, like anti-Semitism was a factor. Healthcare was a factor. These are factors, right? I think the big one was cost of living. Cost of living, real estate costs, and taxes. These are not things that are, Vancouver is known for being, you know, in the middle of the pack or the bottom of the pack. They're very much at the high end of the pack on all these. The cost of living here is about 70%. I'm talking about the housing costs, right? Either to rent or buy is about 75 to 80% less than Vancouver, and that's when you convert it into US dollars. Now, that is a substantial amount of money that is staying within our home for our family, for our kids. Additionally, Oklahoma has a state tax of, I think it's 2.5%, right? So your salary can be for less money, but you end up bringing home more money and it's worth more. So, you know, we were at this stage where we had to make these decisions. We were looking at our kids and thinking about, do we want to live in the same city our kids live in when they grow up? We want them to be able to buy a house. We want them to be able to have job opportunity. And we couldn't really foresee most of that in British Columbia. Could we have moved to another province like a lot of British Columbians who have moved to Alberta? We could have. But, you know, we also said, on a whole, we also were looking at the federal as fighting, combating anti-Semitism, economic, and where it was heading. And so that's kind of how we came to this decision. Now, and I'm very lucky. I was born in the U.S., so I have American citizenship. My kids born from me, so I was able to get them citizenship. My wife isn't. My wife wasn't. We had to go through the green card process, and you know, it took time, it took money, But at the end of the day, we looked at the overall picture and we said, you know what, this is even if this is a stage in our life where we're here for, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, the rest of our life, it's a journey we're going on together, which will always have some obstacles. And, it's also a bit of a culture shock. I was in Canada for 30 years, right? People here are, you have Southern hospitality that's beyond anything I've seen in Canada. Like it's unbelievable, right? But that being said, I find myself saying sorry to everyone. And they make fun of me for saying process instead of process. So, there's all these little things, but, we're enjoying it. The weather here is very nice. The kids have adapted really well to the school system. We have two kids who are neurodiverse. And, I had recently seen what had happened with the attempts in British Columbia to try to cut the autism funding. And, we kind of said, what kind of future do our kids have when it comes to neurodiversity? And I will tell you that the amount of calls, emails, messages, et cetera, that I received after writing that article, I've never received before for anything I've written or anything. I'm still fielding calls from it. And since we're here, I just got a text message from somebody asking me to call them about possibly moving to the US. So there's, people who feel similar will make that decision. Is this a knock against Canada? I don't want it to be a knock against Canada. Like I said, I love the country. I love the people. My mom is still there. My sister-in-law still lives there. My brother-in-law, my niece and nephews, they all still live there. So Canada is a very special place for us. But that's also the reason I'm speaking up. That's also the reason I wrote that article, because by writing that article, it created conversation. And we can't be afraid of having these kind of conversations.
Yeah, the people of Tulsa don't have a $3 billion cost overrun at a place like the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant to deal with. They're not dealing with the FIFA World Cup coming and the probably $1 billion bill to taxpayers. People of Tulsa are also don't have a government workers strike right now. The BCGEU is still on strike. The NDP hasn't been talking to them as of today. At an impasse, and even more workers are out on strike. So BC, British Columbians aren't getting the services they pay for because of this labor dispute. And of course, Tulsa doesn't have anything at all like the downtown east side. There's homeless in major cities around the United States, but nothing that matches the misery of the downtown east side, where
we have no solutions. We have crime, right? We have these. It's not like you just picked up and went and landed in Care Bear country or whatever it is. There's always going to be pros and cons. Those problems, some of which that you just listed off, specifically like the downtown east side, this is not a problem. This has been a problem since I was in high school, right? And it hasn't gotten better. It's only gotten worse. Right. And same thing with the fentanyl problem. Hasn't gotten better. It's only gotten worse. And this has been going on for over 10 years. So at a certain point, right, and that's where I go back to that statement I said, I lost confidence in leadership. This isn't a partisan thing. I mean, I've been asked to run for municipal office. I've been asked to run for provincial office. And I've been asked to run for federal office by different parties. But it's not about the politics. It's about the policy. It's about getting it and doing it right and not doing it on something that is going to punish the majority of British Columbians. And that's what kind of feels like has been happening. And I just, I talk to my family in BC all the time, and they came down and visited. They fell in love with it here. I said, so do you want to move here? Because I came through a program called Tulsa Tomorrow, which is a local program from the Jewish community that, for young Jewish professionals and families that are looking to move. Tulsa Tomorrow will help facilitate it with them and for them. And it's a great program. And, I was looking at it and I said, well, Mom, what do you think? And, the answer was no, Vancouver. their friends are there, and I get it. I said, of course, I get it. We made our decision, right? And everyone's making theirs. I could tell you that this conversation, whether they make the decision to leave, stay, move out of Vancouver to the island, whatever, these conversations are happening around the table, and these are the topics that are spoken about. Maybe not anti-Semitism in the non-Jewish tables, but these are the topics that are being spoken about. And on every one of those topics, it has only gotten worse. Since I left, ER wait times seem to be down. So, okay, maybe that one's not worse, but it has been on a downward trend.
And finally, before I let you go, let's give us your elevator pitch for Tulsa. Maybe put on the hat of Chamber of Commerce or the Tourism Promotion Agency. You know, why should people in Vancouver and anywhere else that's watching this podcast, why should they go visit Tulsa and give Tulsa a chance?
My blood pressure is way lower here. The quality of life is phenomenal. What you can get, you know, if I sold my place in Vancouver, what I was able to get here is something that I never could have dreamed of in Vancouver. You give up things, you sacrifice things. There are things you sacrifice to do a move like this. And each individual person is going to have to look and see if that's the right decision for them. When it comes to Tulsa, it is a city that is described almost as like Austin, Texas 10 years ago. It's bubbly. Oklahoma is one of the fastest growing states in the nation. We are a very business friendly state. And Tulsa is really a beautiful city. I mean, you have a beautiful downtown core. There's been a reinvigoration, and ever since the pandemic, they have been attracting virtual workers to Tulsa. So now there's a bit of a tech bubble. There's a great bar scene and music scene, and it's really something special. If you love waters, if you love, like, you know, going swimming in the ocean, you're going to have a hard time in Oklahoma. But there's beautiful lakes, and I drive to work every day. It takes me 20 minutes. Vancouver took me 20 minutes. Took me 20 minutes, and look at all the gray hair. Okay, I think I'm losing the gray hair. I think my gray hair is going backwards and becoming brown again. Because you drive and you're driving across farms and you're seeing cows, and then you get into Tulsa and it's like you're into the city. And so I think there's a lot of really great benefits for people who want something like that. I was at a point in life, you know, especially after 2 years of fighting anti-Semitism in Canada, and years before that as well, but after such a long period of time of this intense, so it's actually quite nice to come here to a place where there's very little anti-Semitism. You know, able to do the work of, you know, celebrating a Jewish community, fun and engaged on a lot of different projects, including the Tulsa Oilers, who are going to be doing a Tulsa Jewish Heritage Game. Like, that's that sort of stuff is possible here. And, you know, if people are interested, they can look up Tulsa Tomorrow. I mentioned it earlier, TulsaTomorrow.com. Great program. And it's worth taking a peek. But, you know, at the same time, for all my people in Canada, I want them to know that I still care deeply about Canada and Canada's success and their success. Because at the end of the day, we're all one people.
From Vancouver to Tulsa, my guest, Michael Sachs. He's the Senior Director of the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. Thanks again for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Bob. And if you have any sway with the NHL, have them move the Canuck games 2 hours earlier. That'd be great for me, okay?
Excellent.
Thanks.
End of the first week of the fall session of the British Columbia Legislature, and two people that know the BC Legislature more than most and from different angles are joining me to talk about this week in Victoria. Ellen Mullen is the former Chief of Staff to Darrell Plekis, who was the Speaker of the Legislature from 2017 to 2020. And Paul Stanley is the former Chief Security Officer for the British Columbia government from 2017 to 2022. Thanks for joining me. The first week of the legislature is in the history books. Here we are, almost a year since the last provincial election, an election that ended with a close result. But since then, there's been fracturing on the right under the Conservatives, led by John Rastad. And it seems less likely that there will be an early election, that this could last a full 4 years under the current format. Now, David Eby and the NDP right now, however, coming into this legislative session, are facing labor unrest. The BC government workers are on strike. There was one failed attempt last week at a meeting between the two sides. It went nowhere. More workers have joined the picket lines, especially picket lines around the liquor stores and liquor warehouses. They're hoping to hit the government in the wallet. Where do you think this is going? Are we looking at a resolution anytime soon, Alan?
I mean, the sides are so far apart in where they're at and what they're offering and what they're looking for. You know, I'm reminded back when John Horgan was premier, the BCGEU got a fairly hefty raise back then. And I'm not sure that this government can actually afford to give them what they're looking for. There's going to be a lot more pressure. I mean, we've just seen that they've now shut down liquor stores altogether. So, you know, we're going to see the hospitality sector particularly putting some pressure on government to, you know, sort of get back to the table. But, you know, it's even to give a smaller raise, I mean, that translates to millions and millions and millions of dollars a year in what's already sort of a $90 billion budget. There's only so much money that's there. So I don't think we're very close to a resolution on this one. And, you know, we've seen it this week at the legislature. I mean, that entire front lawn at the legislature was full of BCGEU members and supporting unions. And I think they're just going to keep on ramping it up. And we haven't really heard much in the House, certainly in question period, from the opposition, which is kind of odd. It kind of speaks to what you referenced, Bob, the fracturing on the right. You know, there's lots of stuff they could, you know, hold government to task over, the strike being one of them. Like I said, the budget, the crumbling healthcare system, but they're not really doing their job as the official opposition, you know, putting pressure on government. So the union is having to pressure them themselves very publicly. But I, to answer your question, I don't see an end in sight in this one, and not anytime soon.
Yeah, Paul, speaking of the fracturing on the right, the situation with the opposition, one of the controversies that came out of the Conservative caucus this week was John Rastad trying to plug leaks to the media and making sure that everyone who went into caucus put down their mobile phones and let the Conservatives even look over the mobile phones. You come from a security background. That must be a concern across government of how people are using smartphones these days. But here you have the Conservatives worried about information leaking out of caucus into the public domain that might embarrass the leader.
Now, the reason why you would scrutinize personal communication devices, such as iPads, cell phones, that sort of thing, is to make sure that nothing untoward is being distributed, either from the person owning the phone or indeed anyone else having access to it. So what you're saying underneath the radar is, we don't trust you. You know, you come to caucus, we don't trust you. We believe you've got an ulterior motive. And unfortunately, John Rustad is not doing a very good job at garnering confidence in his caucus, let alone the people who are already being ostracized because of their personal statements. And so, you know, you've got to have confidence. If Alan and I have to work together, which we have done many, many times, we know each other very well, we have to have confidence that the one is not going to say something that's going to be deleterious. It's not going to be damaging to the other in order to fulfill what we're trying to achieve. That's the primary element of trust. And it's something fundamental in the security industry. You cannot be responsible for everything that's going on. You have to trust the people that you bring in. And patently, that's not happening.
Yeah, there are some people inside the Conservatives and some people that have left the tent who are saying they've lost trust and confidence in John Rostad and it's time for a new leader. But John Rostad is standing pat. He does have, to his credit, the result of the months-long leadership review. However unspectacular the numbers were, about 900 people, the majority of people who did vote in that process did express their support for him to continue as the leader. So that's where he is there. Is there a wider problem within the Conservative Party altogether that they could only muster about 1,300 people to get involved in that process? Here's a party that came so close this time last year to forming government, just a few seats below what was needed.
The party's in serious trouble. And I think part of the problem is they don't really know their direction. And you have a leader that, you know, has said all along, you know, it's going to be a new and improved Conservative Party. You know, obviously we had the BC Liberals, which was a coalition of the BC Conservatives and BC Liberals. They then became BC United. Well, we all know how that happened. But he and Bruce Bannman, being Rostad and Bruce Bannman, have been very clear from the get-go that it's going to be a party of free speech. And, you know, people can say and do whatever they want and they'll be supported. Well, clearly that's not the case. We've seen Eleanor Serko fired. We've seen Dallas Brody fired, probably with good reason, but that's besides the point. He also recently fired a junior comms staffer for posting to Twitter. And also, you know, he was sort of speaking before the session recently about, you know, he's not going to whip votes. He's not going to whip his caucus. Well, on Monday, he whipped the caucus to leave the chamber on a vote, an NDP motion. They actually left the chamber, so there was nobody there, and they actually called division and then left, which is bizarre. And then yesterday, he whipped his caucus to vote in favor, you know, of 1BC MLA Armstrong's bill to ban gender transitioning procedures for minors. That was ultimately defeated, but obviously by the majority NDP and Sturko and the Greens. But the point I'm making is, you have a caucus that you have some that are very clearly uber right wing conservatives, and then you still have a few that would be more sort of centrist or traditional BC liberals, and you have that constant battle back and forth between the center and the right within the caucus. And you have somebody being John Rustett. And I've known John for a long time. He's been in politics a long time, and he's been a minister of the crown, etc. But I'm not sure it's proven to be a great job for him as leader, because you have a lot of different things going on in the caucus. They're not unified. If they were unified, there is so much that they could, you know, go after, if you will, the government, various issues and items. You know, we've had closures of ERs, you know, in the Lower Mainland and Delta as recent as last weekend, but they're too busy infighting and, you know, some of them supporting Rostad, some of them going against Rostad. They're too busy trying to figure out their own party as opposed to doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is being the official opposition. So that party's in trouble. I think Rostad, you know, his leadership is in trouble unless something drastically changes. And I know Mario Kinsenko, a research poll recently did a poll and shows that the NDP support in the polls has gone up and the Conservatives have gone down. Of course, John Rostad said, well, he doesn't believe that. And if the Premier does, then he should drop the writ. Well, be careful what you wish for, because, I mean, we saw John Horgan do it when they were well ahead. And right now, the Conservatives are not doing anything to garner support within the caucus and also within the public.
Yeah, here we are, with the economy the way it is and the NDP and the deficit the way it is, and a lot of the issues that were ballot box issues during the campaign last year that just have not been resolved, that the economy, healthcare, the fentanyl crisis are issues that, and of course, housing and affordability are issues that remain unsolved, as EB spent a lot of this year being Mr. Elbows Up against Trump. Could the shoe be on the other foot, and could any questions about John Rustad be put aside or even answered and solved? And could David Eby be on the hot seat? What do you think about that, Paul?
Anything's possible in politics. It's a question of you know, I think there is a fundamental issue here, Bob, and it's, call me old fashioned, but you know what? And it's way before Alan's time. Alan will tell you he didn't even know what it was all about when at the time I'm talking about. But in the days of politics in the 70s and 80s, particularly from the UK where I'm from, it was a question of going out there representing the communities you serve and seeing what the electorate wants and being strong in your decision making. It now appears that everyone gets to that point where they can just say their own opinions. There's no galvanization. There's no jointly working towards what's best for the population. I am old fashioned. I believe in the fact that the people come first, and the whole process of that should be based on one thing and one thing alone: what is best for the people of British Columbia at this time. Forget what I think, forget what my religious views are, forget what my political standpoint is, whatever my orientation is, doesn't matter. I don't care. It's not important. The fact is that we should, the elected members of that legislature should be looking at what's best for us. They represent us. We deserve it. We pay for them to do that. And I don't see that happening. I see division because they're all squabbling around. And it's a very sad state of affairs. It really is. Now, is that the only situation that exists in the world? Of course not. But nevertheless, it's very, very difficult for anyone looking on to be keen on getting involved in this if all they see is this constant bickering between them for no apparent reason.
So it's conservative infighting now, but what about NDP infighting? Is that around the corner? And should David Eby be worried, for instance, about that environmental wing of his party migrating to the Greens, who now have a new young leader, Emily Lowen? Should he be worried?
I think, first of all, I wouldn't be too concerned about Emily Lowen at this point. She doesn't have a seat in the House. I can't imagine either of the other two Green members are going to give up their seat for a by-election. And if they did, she'd probably win in Spanish North and the Islands. I'm not sure she'd win West Vancouver, Sea to Sky, but that's besides the point. As Andrew Weaver said, she's very intelligent. She knows what she's doing, but she's very young, and I'm not sure the leadership is necessarily a threat right now. But listen, Eby has his own problems within his caucus, and a certain amount of that goes with the territory. But I do know, even this week in Victoria, within that caucus, there's still, quite a bit of chatter, certainly about Gary Begg. He's the member for Surrey Guildford, as we know. He was the Solicitor General and Minister of Public Safety for a very short period of time before he was essentially booted from caucus, or excuse me, from the cabinet. So there's kind of, a little bit of backroom speech about that. But interestingly enough, Gary challenged the Premier's preferred caucus chair, being Stephanie Higginson, and he actually won. He actually successfully, by a narrow margin, but he did successfully challenge her and took over as caucus chair. Within that caucus, and I think within, the political realm, if you will, in Victoria, that's seen as a direct shot at Eby by Begg. So that sort of right there kind of shows you there is some folks in that caucus, I think they've been around long enough. The NDP machine is sort of strong enough to make sure they don't say it publicly, but they have the convention next month, and there is a leadership review scheduled for that. I also know there are some members in that caucus that plan to, within the convention, challenge Eby's leadership. And now that raised the question, well, who in that caucus would be A, prepared, or B, qualified to take over, number one? And number two, the nice thing about being in government, when you're the premier, and if you've got problems within your caucus or you're the leader, there's a lot of stuff you can do to distract. Because there's always something you can be talking about. I mean, Mike Farnworth has said there's going to be 18 pieces of legislation this session, which is a lot for a 6-week fall session. He can constantly refer back to Donald Trump and the tariffs. He's now in a very public fight, if you will, with the Premier in Alberta. So when John Rustad has problems, there's nothing really to hide behind, because aside from question period, all you have to talk about is the infighting and the misdirection within the Conservatives. Yeah. Whereas when it's with government, all they'll say is, yeah, but let me tell you about Danielle Smith, or let me tell you about all this great stuff we're doing, or let me yell and scream about Donald Trump. And it does kind of distract. Does that mean there's not issues within that caucus? There absolutely is issues, and they're being talked about this week. I know that for a fact.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Taiwan news, Taiwan influencer referred to prosecutors over beheading President Lai comment. Criminal Investigation Bureau cites potential violations of criminal code after Chen Qihan's livestream remarks about Taiwan's president. Chen previously criticized China's influence in Taiwan, but his stance shifted recently. In June, he traveled to Shanghai for a six-day trip with the aim of presenting China positively to his audience. Online spaces in Taiwan are subject to legal regulation, and individuals are responsible for their statements under the law. In Kyoto news, hacker group claims responsibility for Asahi Group ransomware attack. The beverage maker reported a ransomware cyber attack on September 29th, which caused a system failure that forced the company to halt production at many of its domestic factories and postpone the release of some products. Qilin, a ransomware group believed to be based in Russia, claimed in a post on the dark web that it had stolen around 9,300 files, or about 27 gigabytes of data, according to the source. In Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong bars 13 films from screening on national security grounds since 2021 censorship law. No films have been barred from screening in the 5 years before the amended film censorship law was enacted, while 50 films had to be edited in order to be screened during the same period. An inspector authorized by the censorship agency may enter and search premises without a warrant when trying to halt an unauthorized film screening or publication if it is not reasonably practicable to obtain a warrant.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland man stole influencer's tripod at ICE protest, made watery escape attempt, police say. Officers said they hitched a ride in a Portland Fire and Rescue boat and eventually found Nathan V. Khalil hiding in foliage in the lagoon. Police say Khalil used physical force to grab a tripod from Thomas Allen, a conservative live streamer. The 36-year-old was taken to a hospital for treatment of injuries to his hand during the watery escape attempt and then booked into jail on third-degree robbery, a felony, and misdemeanor second-degree criminal mischief. In the Salish Current, monitoring and preparing for an earthquake at Mount Baker. After a record-breaking earthquake swarm near Mount Rainier, researchers around Mount Baker continue to prepare for volcanic activity. Mount Rainier typically has about 10 earthquakes every month, whereas Mount Baker has only a couple every few years. According to Mary Benage, a research geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory, the biggest hazard from Mount Baker is lahars, or volcanic mudflows. The largest known lahar at Mount Baker was about 6,700 years ago. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Should Vancouver and Toronto worry about security at the 2026 World Cup? And Vancouver City Hall withholds all documents from thebreaker.news about controversial street renaming. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Turkey, potato, and cranberry farmers of BC and the people who help bring the tasty goodness to markets and restaurants around the province. A special nod to those who help food banks and charity kitchens feed the less fortunate on Thanksgiving.
And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 12th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 12th of October in 1962, Typhoon Frida hit British Columbia, more than $600 million of damage and 7 deaths? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. And while there, you can sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.